VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Today, we'll talk with a physicist, a theoretical physicist, an astrophysicist, and a professor of planetary sciences about topics ranging from physics, cosmology, humanity's relationship with the universe, the discovery of organic compounds in the atmosphere of a comet, to new findings about Earth's ring current, a key part of the space environment around Earth. My first guest today is Professor Sean Carroll from the California Institute of Technology. He's a theoretical physicist and the author of several books, including his latest, The Big Picture, on the origins of life, meaning, and the universe itself. Professor, wow, you sure roll in a credible range of material in your new book. Is this more of a scientific-based book? Philosophical, or is it a hybrid of all?
Yeah, this is a little bit of everything. There's certainly much more philosophy in there than you would get in a typical science book. And there's no question there's way more science in there than you would get in most philosophy books. So that's because it's about the big picture. It's not really supposed to provide you final answers to any of life's great questions, but to talk about how they might be addressed and talked about given what science has taught us about the world.
As a scientist, a physicist, how can you meld and connect such sophisticated science with philosophy?
Well, we'll see whether or not it was actually a success or not. You know, I think that the divisions that we draw between these different areas can be a little bit artificial sometimes. The philosophy behind the book is that these are all, whether it's physics, philosophy, biology, neuroscience, ways of talking about the world, ways of trying to figure out what the world is, how it behaves, and what lessons we can draw from that. So I'm not an expert in every one of the things that I talk about in the book, but I take some solace in the fact that nobody is an expert on all of these things. And I think that nevertheless, we need to be talking about all of them. So hopefully this is an encouragement to keep that conversation going.
Let's get into a little bit of physics, if you don't mind, some cosmology. Let's start at what many perceive to be the beginning, the Big Bang, an event that supposedly, what we've been told, gave birth to the universe. Can you share your thoughts on the connection of this cosmic event? Was it indeed the beginning of time, or as you put it, could it also be the end of something else?
The short answer is we don't know. And I think that we should be honest about not knowing. Sometimes in casual conversation, physicists, cosmologists give the impression that we know more about what the Big Bang really is and it stands for than we do. They say it's the beginning of space and time itself. If you were before the Big Bang, that's like being north of the North Pole. It's just not a sensible concept. The truth is we don't know. The Big Bang is a prediction of Einstein's general theory of relativity. If you go backward in time from our universe from today to the past, eventually you hit a singularity where the universe was infinitely dense and hot and expanding. But at the same time, we don't believe general relativity is right in that regime. It completely ignores quantum mechanics, which we think is very, very important. So according to what we know right now, the Big Bang might have been the beginning. That's a plausible way to sort of finish putting together the laws of physics. But it also might just have been one moment among many. There could have been space and time before the Big Bang just as well.
If the Big Bang wasn't the beginning of time, what preceded it?
Something else. You know, there's a whole bunch, there's a whole zoo of different models, different ideas proposed by cosmologists that talk about what could have happened before the Big Bang. Maybe it was more or less the reverse of the Big Bang. Maybe the universe was contracting from our current point of view up to that Big Bang, and it was really a bounce from the bang, from the crunching to the banging. Another possibility is that we live in a baby universe, that there was a big universe, it was not contracting, it was almost empty, it was just sitting there not doing that much of anything, but it sort of bubbled off because of quantum fluctuations, a little ball of space-time that was very small and very dense, and that expanded into our universe. So we could literally be the offspring of some parent cosmology.
Well, that brings me to my next question, and that's the multiverse theory. Do you believe that there are indeed other universes beside the one we now occupy?
Certainly very plausible. You know, we live in a universe where we can only see so far because the Big Bang was only 14 billion years ago, and the speed of light is a fixed value, one light year per year. You can't see what's going on 100 billion light years away. So maybe the universe out there is just very, very different from the universe we see. And that's what cosmologists would refer to as a multiverse. Even if it's connected to us, if it's so far away that, you know, we'll never be able to communicate with it and conditions are very different there, we would call that an entirely different universe.
What are some of the key people who made science what it is today, made the world what we have today happen?
Oh, there's so many. And, you know, some of the big names, of course, Isaac Newton, Galileo, Charles Darwin, Albert Einstein, of course. I think that Ludwig Boltzmann is a guy who deserves more popular press than he gets sometimes. He was an Austrian physicist in the 1800s who helped us understand entropy and the arrow of time. Going back even further, there was a guy around the year 1000 called Ibn Sina. His name was sometimes romanized to be Avicenna. He was Persian at the Islamic Golden Age in the year 1000, where, you know, Christians were busy doing other things, but a lot of Muslims were advancing the cause of science. And Ibn Sina in particular put his finger on the idea that if you were out in empty space, there was vacuum around you, and you were moving, you would just keep moving. You would not slow down and come to rest. And this was a dramatic change from what Aristotle, who was the dominant force in physics or metaphysics at the time, would have predicted. Aristotle says that to keep things moving, you have to keep pushing them. But the very idea that things just keep moving by themselves was a real game changer as far as how we think about the fundamental nature of reality.
There's been a lot of interesting findings, particularly over the last 10 years or so. Earlier this year, Einstein's theoretical gravitational waves were detected. What are your thoughts on that and the importance of the detection of these formerly theoretical waves?
It's a spectacular demonstration, both of the extraordinary abilities of the experimenters, the 1,000 or so people who worked on LIGO, the Laser Interferometric Gravitational Wave Observatory, but also of our power as human beings to understand the universe. You know, if you think about it, literally 100 years ago, Albert Einstein had just finished developing his general theory of relativity, and with pencil and paper, sitting down writing equations, he was able to reach his brain across the cosmos and predict the existence of gravitational waves. And a century later, and, you know, a couple billion dollars later, and 1,000 people working very hard, we see this incredibly tiny jiggle of mirrors here on Earth that indicate that there were massive black holes that spiraled into each other millions of years ago. So the fact that it all works, the fact that it fits exactly what our theoretical predictions were, is just a tremendous testimony to how good science is at understanding the world.
Professor Sean Carroll, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk with us.
Thanks for having me on. It's been great.
That was theoretical physicist and professor Sean Carroll from the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, California. His new book, published by Dutton, is called The Big Picture: On the Origins of Life, Meaning, and the Universe Itself. Joining us via Skype is Professor Catherine Altweg from the University of Bern, Switzerland. Professor Altweg is also the principal investigator of the Rosina spectrometer that's aboard the European Space Agency's comet-chasing space probe, Rosetta. She and her team recently found a couple of chemical compounds that are crucial elements in living organisms in the atmosphere or coma of comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko. Professor Altweg, what did you and your team find in the data gathered from 67P's coma?
A coma is a gas and dust cloud surrounding the comet because it consists of ice and dust. If it comes closer to the sun, the gas will sublimate. It will carry dust along, and this will then give the coma just the cloud around the comet.
Was the chemicals also detected, the compounds detected on the comet itself?
No. You know, there was a lander, but unfortunately it didn't get enough material to really look for glycine, for the amino acid.
So what tools did you use to make your finding?
The instrument, it's called Rosina, consists of two mass spectrometers. And the mass spectrometer is an instrument which sorts the molecules according to their mass. So the molecules are in the gas, they come into the instrument, and then we sort them according to their mass. And from the mass, we then define the composition.
And can you tell us a little bit about your thoughts on how these compounds could have been created? You said they weren't found on the surface of the comet itself. So how did they show up in the comet's coma?
I'm sure they are on the surface of the comet. They're just not found there.
And how close was the comet to the sun at the time?
The first time we saw it, it was still about 400 million kilometers away from the sun. So it was very far from the sun. And I think glycine is not very volatile. You need 150 degrees Celsius to get it into gas phase from the solid. So I think what happened is that glycine is on the dust grains, and once the dust grains are released from the comet, they heat up in the sun. Because they are black, they are small, so they get very high temperatures, and that's when they release the glycine then.
I understand that a search for these particular chemical compounds were also made on two other comets, but nothing was found.
Yes, they looked for them in Hale-Bopp, which was a very bright comet. But, you know, it's a very rare species. It's not very abundant. And I think you have to look for it in situ, so around the comet, not from remote sensing with telescopes.
Let's discuss, if we could, the chemical compounds that were found through your research. Phosphorus, glycine, and what are methylamine and ethylamine?
These are actually simpler molecules than the glycine itself, but they also contain hydrogen, nitrogen, and carbon. And if you then mix methylamine with CO2, you can get glycine out of it. So that's how probably the amino acid formed in the first place. You start with methylamine, you add CO2, and then you get amino acid.
So I understand. Glycine is the amino acid?
Yes, that's the amino acid.
Are there different kinds of amino acids?
Yes, glycine is actually the most simple amino acid there is. And it's probably the only one which can be formed without having liquid water. For all the other amino acids to form them, you need liquid water. And there is certainly no liquid water on the comet.
Let's talk a little bit, if we can, about some of the theories about the creation of life on Earth. Can you tell us about the theory that organic molecules were brought to the planet when small-bodied objects, such as perhaps even pieces of a comet, crashed into Earth's terrestrial oceans?
We know of the Earth's formation that the Earth had several impacts with big objects, and probably each time the Earth lost its oceans and its atmosphere. So the last big impact was 3.8 billion years ago and was then forming the moon. So the Earth at that time was dry. And then probably the water came from the interior of the Earth. So the Earth has lots of water in its interior, and then you can recreate the ocean. But relatively soon after, there was life on Earth. And one hypothesis is that you can do that if you get the organics from outside, because it would take too long on Earth to create the organics itself. Then it's comets, which could crash into the ocean of the Earth and bring the organics. And because comets, as we see it, have all ingredients needed, that could have started life.
So you would be comfortable in saying that your team's findings support this theory?
It makes this theory more likely, let's state it like this.
And why do you think finding these chemical compounds on 67P, Churyumov-Gerasimenko, is important? What does it actually reveal?
Well, it shows that these organic molecules, which were not created in the solar system, they were created before. So they were formed in the precursor of the solar system in the star-forming regions. And that's something you observe throughout our galaxy, these star-forming regions. And now we know that in these regions, apparently, amino acids are formed. And now we can generalize. Comets brought maybe organics to the Earth, but comets or similar objects could have brought organics to anywhere in our galaxy. So to another planet, the likelihood that there is life out there has become bigger now.
Professor Altweg, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk with us today.
You're very welcome.
That was Professor Catherine Altweg from the University of Bern, Switzerland. She's also the principal investigator of the Rosina spectrometer that's aboard the European Space Agency's comet-chasing Rosetta space probe. We spoke with her via Skype. You're listening to the science edition of Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. I'd like to remind you that Press Conference USA is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA, or send us an old-fashioned email to PCUSA@voanews.com. We'll be back with more of our program after this.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
We're back with the science edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. We now talk with Martina Giulidu, a senior professional staff physicist at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory. She's also the lead author of a new study that found electric current, or ring current, a key part of the space environment around Earth, behaving in such a way that's different than what had been understood. Martina, can you give us a bit of an overview about Earth's ring current?
So the ring current is an electrical current that surrounds the Earth, hence the name ring, and is carried by positive ions, mainly protons, of energies from tens to hundreds of kV.
What's kV?
Yes, exactly. So if we want to understand what these energies mean, protons of those energies move with speeds of thousands to hundred to tens of thousands of kilometers per second. So these guys are really fast. And just to get an idea of where in space the ring current is located, it extends from 10,000 to 60,000 kilometers above the Earth. And just for reference, the Earth's radius is about 6,500 kilometers.
So how does this ring affect us on Earth? What does it actually do?
So before I go there, let me give you a bit of a brief history of the ring current. So scientists suspected that such current must exist even from the early 20th century, and that's because instruments called magnetometers that measure the Earth's magnetic field on the ground would observe a global decrease of the Earth's surface magnetic field during what now we know as geomagnetic storms. So in general, electrical currents produce magnetic fields, and these magnetic fields will disturb any background magnetic field, in which case the Earth's magnetic field. That's what we would call remote sensing of the ring current, which is measuring from a distance, if you will. Now, since then, we've had the rise of the space age, multiple satellites were launched and flew through the same region where the ring current is produced. So scientists were actually able to observe the particles that the ring current is made of.
When you're talking about solar storms and mm-hmm. geomagnetic storms, does this mean that the ring current actually rises and falls depending on whether or not there are solar storms happening?
What we study, the reason we study the near space is because we want to understand what we call space weather. And that's even harder to predict than the normal weather.
Mm-hmm.
In space community, we have a saying which is, when the sun sneezes, the Earth is actually catching a cold. So what is happening in our sun, which is huge explosions and where the sun spits a lot of material, charged particles in space, these guys eventually make it to the Earth's near-Earth space environment. So during what we call geomagnetic storms, we have a lot of those particles coming our way that could cause all sorts of troubles in the space close to our planet. And so the ring current in particular consists mainly of protons of solar wind origin. If I go back to your question of how ring current in particular affects us on Earth, there are two main points. For one thing, it drives a global system of electrical currents, both in space and on Earth's surface, and especially during intense geomagnetic storms, such currents induced on the ground could cause severe damages to our power grids, for example. Another way that ring current affects us is through the changes it causes to the near-Earth magnetic field. And this magnetic field controls the motion of even higher energy particles, what we call the radiation belt particles, that actually can harm our satellites.
So let me ask you, Martina, is Earth's ring current, is it similar or is it akin to Earth's magnetosphere?
Oh, the Earth's ring current is a current that exists in the Earth's magnetosphere, but the Earth's magnetosphere is very, very vast. It's huge. It can expand from one Earth radii all the way to 60 or 100 Earth radii away. So the region I'm talking about, it goes only the way only up to 6 Earth radii. So it's a small region of the Earth's magnetosphere.
Now, you're lead author of a new study of the ring current, and it was published by the journal Geophysical Research Letters. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what you found in your research?
Sure. So, as I mentioned earlier, the ring current consists of particles of a variety of energies, ranging from low tens of kV to high hundreds of kV, which, remember, translate into different speeds. And also what we knew so far is that the ring current becomes more intense during geomagnetic storms. Now what we found out after looking at 1 year of continuous ion data is that there is a substantial persistent ring current around the Earth even during non-storm times. And this current is carried by high-energy protons. So what is happening during geomagnetic storms is that we have an enhancement of the ring current, mainly due to new low-energy protons that enter the near-Earth region. So understanding how these two different populations behave is important when it comes to creating computer models that try to predict the variations of the ring current. So trying to predict the storm time ring current enhancement while ignoring the substantial pre-existing ring current is kind of like trying to describe an elephant after seeing only its feet.
Matina, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today about your research into Earth's ring current.
Thank you very much.
That was Matina Gulidu, a senior professional staff physicist at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel, Maryland. She is also the lead author of a new study that found Earth's ring current behaves in a way that's different than what had been understood. Our fourth and final guest today is Professor Priyamvada Natarajan from Yale University. She's also an astrophysicist, cosmologist, and author of a new book called Mapping the Heavens, The Radical Scientific Ideas That Reveal the Cosmos. Priya, there seems to have been a real outpouring of findings and discoveries regarding the universe we live in. So what are some of your thoughts about these new findings?
I think that it's a very, very exciting time to be an astronomer and an astrophysicist, partly because I think what we're seeing here is the confluence of ideas and instruments. So we see that the technology has finally become so sophisticated that we're able to go out and make these incredible discoveries. And, you know, we've been at it, for example, for the LIGO detection, this experiment has been trying for about 40 years, right? And so it's just that the timing is perfect. It's an amazing time to be alive because our technology is so finally catching up with our radical ideas about the cosmos and how things ought to work.
And speaking of Einstein, tell us a little bit about your thoughts about the genius Einstein. Could a figure like him even exist today?
You know, I'm not one for hero worship in general, mm-hmm. but Einstein is the exception. I think what I find most intriguing about Einstein, and which I write a lot about in my book, is that, you know, Einstein proposed some of the most radical ideas. He reconceptualized gravity. He really was a most profound thinker. Yet, with all of his radical ideas, he was an intriguing character because when the implications of his ideas were explicated by other scientists, he actually resisted some of them. So, for example, he came up with the Einstein field equations, this whole theory of general relativity, which allows you to understand, you know, this profound insight that the geometry, the fate, and the contents of the universe are interlinked. But when the solution to one of his issues inevitably suggested that our universe ought to be expanding, he resisted the idea because he loved the classical notion of a static universe, right? Mm-hmm. And there was data that the astronomer Edwin Hubble was gathering that showed sort of incontrovertible evidence for the universe expanding. And it took Einstein a very long time to be persuaded of this. I mean, it's only when the data became overwhelming and he could no longer hold out, he actually gave up, and at a conference he stood up and said, okay, I was wrong, the universe is expanding. But the amazing thing is, this was in 1929, is that some astronomers have found an unpublished manuscript in the Einstein archives dated 1931, so like 2 years after he publicly admitted that, okay, maybe the universe is expanding. And what you see is an unsubmitted manuscript where Einstein was struggling to make the universe static. So even though he sort of scientifically knew, it was this emotional, psychological resistance. And I thought this is why I find him to be so intriguing. Similarly, one of the solutions to his equations is the solution of a black hole. He did not like the solution because of the singularity that is encased in the black hole, right? And so it took him a long time to kind of accept. He thought they may be mathematical entities, but they really couldn't be real.
So let's talk a little bit about black holes. What are black holes exactly, and how are they formed?
Black holes are very intense condensations of matter. They are so intense that they cause a puncture in space-time. So our entire universe can be represented as a sheet, as a fabric where locations are described by four numbers, the three spatial locations, the X, Y, Z coordinates, as well as time. So the entire universe is this sheet. We are on this sheet. There's nothing above this sheet. There's nothing below this sheet. And the presence of mass in the sheet, so if you have the sun, for example, it would cause a little bump in the sheet. So anything that has mass causes an indentation. So the bump that is caused by the sun is sort of like a gentle bump. But the black hole matter is so tightly concentrated, it is so dense, that it actually causes a puncture in space-time. Don't ask me where the puncture takes you to, okay? So it's actually the compactness of the black hole that causes this extreme bending of space-time. And we now have a pretty good idea of how black holes form as well.
Dark matter and dark energy, what is it? Is it for real?
They are for real. They are for real. And I think what must be really hard for the curious public to understand is, you know, how are these entities that are so invisible, how do you believe in them when in the past we thought ether existed and it went away? But, you know, dark matter and dark energy are here to stay because we really have many, many independent lines of evidence showing us indirectly that they exist in the universe. So most of the matter in the universe, 90% or so, is made of the stuff, which is something exotic. It's not ordinary atoms, not the stuff that we are made of. We think it's some particle in the early universe that constitutes dark matter. We are yet to find it. But it's there because it's matter and it exerts gravity. So it affects the motions of, for example, stars and galaxies. So galaxies have a large amount of dark matter, unseen matter. But the stars feel the gravity and therefore are whizzing around faster than they would if what we see is what we have, which is if stars were the only thing that were around, they wouldn't be moving around so fast. They couldn't. And similarly, dark matter does something else, which also Einstein predicted, which is the bending of light. And we see that as well in the universe. So I think the existence of dark matter is enigmatic, but I don't think it's questionable. It's really there, and it's a question of how soon can we directly detect this particle.
Your book is called Mapping the Universe. How do you go about mapping a universe?
Mapping is really trying to figure out where the contents are spatially. So I play both with the literal and the metaphorical meaning of mapping. So a lot of my own research work revolves around mapping dark matter. So even though we don't see it, with light bending, we actually know quite exquisitely how dark matter is distributed in the universe. So, for example, we know it's lightly smeared in some places and it's lumped in certain places. So in the book, I really talk about how the contents of the universe are revealing themselves to us, even if they remain directly unseen. And when I start off the book, I really use maps literally, and I show how early on our conceptions of cosmos and how they changed from, say, the 13th century onwards. I use a set of iconic maps and show how our changing view of the cosmos gets reflected in maps, how we are creating new ones for this century.
Priya, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk to us.
Thank you so much. It was delightful.
That was Professor Priyamvada Natarajan from Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. She's also an astrophysicist, cosmologist, and author of a new book printed by Yale University Press called Mapping the Heavens, The Radical Scientific Ideas That Reveal the Cosmos. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this science edition of Press Conference USA. I'd like to thank all of our guests for joining us today, as well as Anna Zaleski for all her help in producing today's program. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.